Accession number 30143, Reel 5.
Try and give you your right.
right name.
Matthew Cook, and it's Reel 5.
Just again, some of the preparation in Kuwait City, obviously preparing to cross into Iraq. This was just before the war had started. Richard and I went round to some of the supermarkets. It was because it's all on expenses, and instead of going for the cheap foods, you could buy whatever you wanted, really. Prices had gone up. Obviously, the canny Kuwaitis realised that there was this press pack of, I think someone mentioned 4,000, which is vast. So I think they're aware. They just put the prices up through the roof. We bought a generator, fuel cans. The price had gone, I don't know, you're paying a couple of $100 for fuel drums that were $20 before, so people were making a buck out of it. Obviously bottled water, and just preparing food. With him, I went round, went to a few supermarkets. I was trying to get canned tin food that would use ring pulls, so you didn't need a can opener. I didn't have a can opener, so you know, it was quite thought out. We've got a gas stove that's small enough, a small pot. The plan was that both of us were going to cross in with all of this kit. That was the plan. Obviously it doesn't work like that. As a backup, I had a small hexamine solid fuel stove, which is what the army cook on. So it's literally something that could fit into a pocket. So that was always my backup. So I brought that in from the UK. Now, just prior, again, maybe it was probably on the first day of the conflict, Richard got a call from the newspaper and his task to meet up with another writer, which sent me into a bit of a panic. Like, gulp, I'm going to have to do this alone. And sure enough, at very short notice, he said, right, I'm off, you know, sorry about this, we got on quite well. He said, you know, you're okay hiring another car, buying more food, buying your own generator, starting all over again. And in fact, he had a guy, a sort of fixer, he wasn't actually a very good fixer, but he was a Lebanese guy. And I think he had in a lock-up garage somewhere in Kuwait City some leftovers from another journalist that had either come and gone in the weeks prior to the conflict, and he'd left loads of supplies. So Richard said, don't worry, there's all this food and gas stoves and stuff, you can just go and pick it up and it'll be sorted. Get a new four-wheel drive, so hard to come by. I was using Hertz car rental at the airport, and again, their prices had tripled. They're milking it, and I had to. They asked me to sign a disclaimer saying that I wouldn't take the vehicle into Kuwait. So I bluffed it by saying, "Oh, thanks for this sheet of paper. I'll just, I went through all the paperwork for the hire car, and then just said, I'll speak to the office tonight, and I'll bring this back tomorrow, and we'll sort it out." And then never mentioned it again. So got away with it. So now I was on my own in a big four-wheel drive. Kuwait City is not easy to get round. It's a lot of motorways and circular system, and every junction looks the same. And so quite daunting. I was desperate to try and get a map of Iraq, but since the invasion in 1991, Kuwait had made it illegal to have maps of Iraq. So you weren't going to find one anywhere. Very strange. I ended up going and picking up this food that the other journalists, and I didn't look at it too closely. I just bundled these bags into my boot. And in hindsight, sure enough, none of the cans were ring pull. They were all sort of can opener things. I had bought a gas stove with the wrong gas bottles, so I couldn't use that. It was obviously somebody who just hadn't thought it through. So it was frustrating that I'd gone to the effort to think it through. Richard had obviously done well out of it, and there was I, having been smart enough, but now with not the means to cook, and lots of tins that I couldn't open. So anyway, and I was on my own. So then Richard was kind enough to go through over a couple of nights, and I'd write down literally how to scan my drawings, how to save them onto the laptop, how to caption them. Captions were quite obviously quite important for the newspapers. How to send them, who to send them to, setting up the satellite phone, which sort of region of the world you log into, and the direction it's got to face. It's got a little compass on it, and which part of the night sky you point it in. So all of these sort of things I had to learn very quickly, and before I knew it, you know, 1 or 2 days into the war, and I was on my own, and this wasn't how it was meant to be. In between, I'd gone on a couple of trips. The Navy flew me out to the HMS Edinburgh, which is a Type 42 destroyer out in the Gulf, and a sort of helicopter landing platform, which was, I can't remember what it's called. It's the only ship that's larger than the Ark Royal. It's sort of amphibious landing ship. So that was quite a different break of, you know, routine from the dust, you know, to actually be flown out. And it was just me. It was no other media. So suddenly I was beginning to like this being. It was terrifying, but it was nice to be on your own. So flown by Sea King, a couple of hours out into the Gulf, and winched down onto the destroyer because it couldn't take the large helicopter. So it was beginning to get exciting for me, and I'm beginning to find my own pace and sort of interesting stuff. Also, I think we were bussed into Iraq for when the humanitarian aid was delivered on the Royal Fleet Auxiliary Sir Galahad. So it was like, from all the, I love Vietnam War films, it was like The Killing Fields, or where the media had bussed into an incident. You know, literally in a coach with blacked out windows, dropped off at the, you know, you can still hear the shelling in Basra, you know, the black smoke filling the sky, spend 6 or 7 hours watching whatever orchestrated bit of the war you're meant to watch, back on the bus and shipped back to the Sheraton in Kuwait City. So it's very bizarre, and you had to pinch yourself that night while you're doing the drawings, you know, sipping your non-alcoholic beer in the room. My God, was I really in Iraq this morning? That was so weird. So yeah, in many ways it was good. I wasn't living in a trench, and well, not yet. So I had quite a luxurious side to it. I've forgotten to mention some of the missile attacks. As I said, I had to go and buy a scanner. I've never owned or bought a scanner in my life. And eventually, after getting lost quite a bit, I found my way into central Kuwait in my new hire car. There was another sandstorm blowing in, so visibility was really, really low. And the Americans had built up a ring of Patriot defence missiles, sort of anti-missile missiles, to protect the city, because they knew that the Iraqis would fire missiles just to harass. And sure enough, I was in a sort of Kodak shop buying this scanner, which I just prayed it had the right connecting cables to and would work in my laptop. And, you know, the salesman, of course, was going, yeah, of course it'll work. And he just wanted the cash for a scanner. And sure enough, the air raid siren went off. I went running out. All of the staff in the shop ran to this huge plate glass window, which even I thought wasn't going to be good if a missile comes in. So I left them to it. I just ran out into the middle of a rather deserted car park. As I said, it had about 50 metres visibility, so all I could see is just the edge of a few cars, a few palm trees, very little beyond that. And this constant wailing, and then there's a huge explosion, followed by a second explosion. I wasn't sure at the time if that was incoming, but in hindsight they were the Patriot missiles launching, because I couldn't see how far away they were. It felt like a couple of hundred metres away, so very, very noisy. That set off all sorts of car alarms, that birds were flying around in panic. Then people started screaming, people on the floor, and it became all rather panicky. I was just lying there, just sort of trying to take it all on board, saying, should I put my respirator on or should I not bother? I feel a bit of an idiot, no one else is. And I did put my respirator on, and I thought, sod them, it's a chemical attack. And then I heard a couple of secondary explosions out over the Gulf, fairly distant away, sound about a kilometre away, and I just prayed that was the incoming missile being destroyed. And sure enough, after 3 or 4 minutes, the all clear was sounded, a slightly different alarm, and sort of dusted myself off and went back to pick up my scanner.
And your batch.
It was. That's what a missile attack's like. In fact, that wasn't the first missile attack. I think it was the morning of that day. I was on, again, being bused down to an American some logistics base slightly south of Kuwait City. And I was drawing some Americans queuing for the food hall and fixing their Humvee vehicles. And this must have been on the day the war started. And the air raid siren started just as I was driving out of the base, sort of midway out. So I just left the vehicle, I left it with the keys in, but managed to turn the vehicle off. And I ran, there were various concrete bunkers dotted around, surrounded by sandbags. So ran putting my respirator on. This was the first proper. Go back a bit. With an American voice on the tannoy, it was going lightning, 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 just repeating lightning, which apparently was a code word that it was a real missile attack. So this was the first time it had happened, and the Americans were obviously all a bit panicky. About 10 of us bundled into this tiny concrete shelter. We're sitting with the knees up to your chest and the respirator on, obviously. And there was one female American soldier who was crying, just sobbing in her respirator. Another black guy, American soldier, opposite me, was just crossing himself and praying. I was quite relaxed. I thought, okay, it's a missile. The Iraqis haven't got anything that accurate. Chances of it landing on this one concrete shelter is pretty slim, and it's the first shot of the war. Don't even know it's towards this base. It might be Kuwait City. You know, it's anything across the border. It set off the alarms in all of Kuwait. So, yeah, I thought I did my quick sums and just thought, okay, I'm only worried if it's a chemical attack, and it's not going to be good. So I got my sketchbook out and did my. I've still got one of the drawings upstairs. I sort of don't want to sell that one. It still means quite a lot. And, the first shot in the first war that I'd sort of seen. So very poignant in my memory. That was my sort of initial baptism. It turned out that the missile, I only found this out about a year ago doing some internet search and from reading a few books, that the missile was, I guess, called an Ababil. And it was launched towards the American 101st Airborne, where I'd been the day before, that their airbase was the target. And I think Patriot missiles blew it up before it even hit, so it was all good all round. And then back to the hotel that night to do the drawings and to scan and send the drawings of us all with our respirators on in the bunker.
So you were sending all the time, were you?
Yes, every day I'd send drawings. I think the only night, I think it's Saturday night I didn't, because I knew there was no Sunday paper, so that was the only night off. Or whatever I'd drawn, I'd send on the Monday. Wasn't any point in sending.
Yeah, I still quite understand how you got them off. Did you use anything in your car to send them?
Oh, I'll tell you that later. At the moment, I'm still in the hotel, so I'm not living off my car yet.
I'm just plugged in a mass of wires,
and yes, I've opened the window and satellite phones sort of facing
right,
out the window.
Yes.
So at the moment, it's still very civilised and just using all their plug sockets. And thankfully, they've got some British plugs. I hadn't even thought of that. But then back that night, I just sent that night's drawings, and there was a clattering whoosh above. It's the only way I can describe it. It sounded like a propeller aircraft, but something clattering. It sounded strange, never heard anything like it above the hotel. no air raid warnings or anything. And it only sounded sort of 100 foot above. And I ran outside, and all the staff obviously ran to the air raid shelter, which is a sort of ballroom or gambling room in the basement of the hotel. So I, for some reason, I ran out onto the lawn to see what it was, naively. And yes, yeah, so good to see some afterburners of the. I didn't realise it then, but it turned out to be a missile. And I thought it was a cruise missile. You know, I remember seeing so many film footage of cruise missiles finding a way around the streets, and I just assumed if there's no air raid warning, it's going to be friendly fire right on the beach. It's going to have come from one of the American troops and their ships out in the Gulf. And there was a faint secondary an explosion some kilometres down the beach. And of course, reading in the next day, it was fired from Basra City, or maybe Al-Four, that's marshy land. And it was an anti-ship missile that had been fired, so they skimmed low over the water for some reason and just skipped over the hotel and exploded on the beach down, you know, a few kilometres down. I think the next few days it became, not every day, but there are quite a few of them. One hotel, another Silkworm missile hit a shopping centre, which is where I bought all my food and things. So suddenly it was all getting a bit close, and I wasn't even in Iraq yet. So yeah, it was very strange, and it evokes weird emotions that someone's, you can't help it. It's almost personal. Yes, someone's endangering my life, or someone really, really wants to kill me. But it's not personal, because it's just because I'm an infidel Westerner. They don't care that it's Matthew Cook or a war artist. As long as it's an infidel, it doesn't really matter. So it's just a very strange mindset that, hang on, someone's really trying to kill me. It sounds, again, maybe naive, but probably not quite as personal as someone taking aim and shooting with the firearm, but it's still an area weapon being pointed in my direction. Yeah, it was a subconsciously something changes in you, and you think, just a weird. I still haven't got to grips with that. It's probably the first time I've chatted about it, really. But an interesting one. I'll tell you when I think that one through. But yes, those were the first initial missile attacks, and then the war had really started. And as I said, there were these trips across into Iraq, and eventually I got, not through lack of trying, there was one of the aforementioned Times writers who did manage to cross through. It was the British Army who had basically secured the border between Kuwait and Iraq, and the military police are very thorough, so if you haven't got the right paperwork, there's no way you can bluff it. Richard and I used to bluff it through the Kuwaiti checkpoints. You know, they were ordered not to let media through, but I had my Ministry of Defence, it's called Mod 90, which is an ID card, and Richard used to be in the RAF, and he had his RAF, so we bluffed it. I shouldn't say that. So we could get as far, but as soon as you got to the British MPs, there was no way you could get through. So what we wanted to do was just cross the border, go into Iraq on our own, and just see what we saw. But after numerous attempts, it wasn't going to happen. We did camp up in some farm buildings. Again, the Bangladeshi farm workers had all left, so these sort of abandoned buildings that you could sort of nudge the door open or shimmy through a window. So we stayed a few nights right on the border with the bombing going on, but again, couldn't find a way across the tank berms, and we knew they were mined, so it wasn't a sensible idea. But for a spell there, we met the aforementioned photographer and Times writer who kept taking my name off various lists, and they did manage to get through somehow, and I think it was with a Sun reporter, so there was three or four of them managed to find their way, God knows how, somehow through the wire and not through one of the checkpoints. And the British, for some reason, allowed them through the last checkpoint, and the troops there, so the story goes, didn't even tell them that, you know, this is the last friendly checkpoint, the rest is all, you know, bandit country. And they drove on towards Basra, before they got to one of the bridges to cross into Basra, they came under fire from an Iraqi checkpoint. They'd obviously been commanded, anything comes down that road, shoot it, it's not ours. And obviously a big four-wheel drive hire car. So the Times writer, he had four rounds hit his car. One hit the fuel tank on his roof, one went through the windscreen, and one went through his engine block. So he immediately put the vehicle into a spin and drove back out and came back through Safwan, which is a border town, where some kids lobbed bricks at his car, so he got a brick through the windscreen. He came back really shaken up, but I had no sympathy for the guy. And because of that, the army completely clamped down on letting any media into the zone, that literally no media to pass unless they've been okay. So he stuffed it up for the entire media pack. Anyway, so still gets me.
Not the most popular man.
He got a great story. I don't know if he wrote about it, but I have no idea. Yeah, hating to add, while all this was happening, or if you're sleeping up in the farms, I had no idea what was happening in the war. So I literally had no idea, even though it was a few kilometres away, you can hear the artillery firing. I had no idea what was going on, which is very strange. And because there were no maps, did I say that on record, that the maps... Again, I haven't been able to confirm this, but the story is that maps were made illegal in Kuwait after the Iraq invasion. Why would anyone want to go to Iraq, let alone buy a map of it? So, tourist guides in the Hilton, there was nothing of Iraq, plenty of maps of Kuwait. So, one of the newspapers, I get newspapers from the Hilton, which seemed to be the sort of centre whenever you bust off into Iraq, it was always from the Hilton. And they would get newspapers, I don't know, 5 or 6 days late. And obviously their police had gone through, their sort of religious police, so if there's any pictures of bare-chested men even, they'd have nipples blacked out, or any bums, all be blacked out by hand. So literally every newspaper, if someone would have gone through editing anything, which is quite amazing. But thankfully, one of the issues that had one of my drawings in, it had a sort of a graphic map of Basra and the lower part of where the fighting was going on in Safwan. It had the border crossing and a couple of the railways, so it was more positioning of troops and what was happening. But it was enough for me, I thought, it's all I had, so I tore it out and I thought, right, I'll navigate by that. And thank God it worked. I'd also bought a sort of A4 folder where I had been chopping out drawings that I'd had printed. So I thought, if I just rock up to military bases, it's far easier if I actually got something to show them. So yes, I had my sketchbook, so I could show them the drawings I've done of, some of the RAF bases and things. By that time, I'd got quite a selection of drawings. And a selection of the printed ones, so they could see that I wasn't a threat. I didn't write stories, so they could say whatever they wanted. Try and make myself as approachable. So, in the meantime, I was trying to get permission now to cross the border. Now it had all been locked down, which came through after a number of rather fretful days. And it turns out in that time, the Royal Horse Artillery had seen one of my drawings in the Times, and they'd been trying to get me across the border but couldn't get in touch with me. So I'd been desperate to go, they'd been desperate to get me out there, but obviously between speaking to London and all the rest, it just, the two never quite worked out. But a message came through that they wanted me. At last I got the paperwork signed, and with a big gulp, I think this was just as I got my food and fuel, all the tinned food, it was too late to change it, so I just had to put up with it. And across I went, by myself, at last I had the paperwork to cross the border. It's rather intimidating, the actual border crossing. It's like a wriggly tin roof and literally just two barriers and probably 15 foot of no man's land. You go past some of the previous United Nations, they'd pulled out a few weeks beforehand. So there's a couple of lookout towers as you approach the demilitarised zone, and then there's a sort of five that are sort of guarded by razor wire, hunting rows of razor wire and some tank ditches. And then there'd be this 5 kilometres of no-go at DMZ that had a really windy road, so you couldn't just drive straight through it, really wound to. Then you came to the last Kuwaiti police post, which was abandoned and sandbagged up and all blown up. Having said that, driving up to that, you drive along the Basra Road, the infamous one from the 91 conflict, which has all been obviously retarmacked and rebuilt. But again, going back, that's just reminded me, almost on the first day there, we found the tank graveyard from the 91 conflict, which was fascinating. I could still be drawing there now, except for all the depleted uranium rounds. It was completely out of bounds, and we were chased off by some Kuwaiti military who saw us and wanted our film, and it all got a bit nasty. So
what was it like there, this graveyard of the...
It was fascinating. It's just rows of vehicles. Some had bits of clothing and boots, and you know, if you look too close, it was a bit grisly, but civilian cars, trucks, radars, just amazing. They're obviously all stacked up and just left in this open bit of desert, so a few kilometres away. Just fascinating.
Were you able to do sketches? Did you have long enough there to do some work?
I did a couple of black and white line sketches and rattled off lots of film, but we knew that we were going to be chased off the police post. We couldn't hide the car, really, so it's a bit vulnerable. In fact, that just reminds me, again, a bit of toing and froing. Just before I crossed into the border, the vehicle I had was a white four-wheel drive. Most of the vehicles out in the Middle East are white just to reflect the heat, which I never thought about beforehand. So I bought some black, some fluorescent orange paper from an art shop in Kuwait. I was stocking up on sketchbooks as well. So I put this panel on the bonnet, and it was the International, or the United Coalition Forces recognition, or an air recognition. So always worried about American aircraft coming in. So I had this nice huge orange panel on my front bonnet, and I used some black tape as a chevron marker that again marked friendly forces in this conflict. So I had those on either side. And just by one of the farms, there was an irrigation ditch where they'd obviously been spraying that day. And so there was some muddy sand. And I just covered my vehicle in mud and sand and just did my best to make it sort of blend in. But yeah, unfortunately, I still look like a very obvious foreigner in a wealthy hire car, which you don't see much on the Iraqi roads. But I felt a bit happier having tried. I made sure I hadn't cleaned the car for how many days. Well, the hotel, there was a guy who always go around and cleaned all the press packs for cars. They all come out going, "No, what have you done?" And he thought he was doing everyone a favour. Why did they leave their cars so dirty? Anyway, so yeah, at last there I was. I'd taken my bed sheet, well, naughtily nicked it out of the hotel to cover that big four-wheel drive, and all the back is wide open, so you can see my generator and fuel cans and food, which to any Iraqi is like, wow, that's useful. So with my bed sheet, I covered it all up, so at least it was covered. So I thought I'd done everything I could, got through the last the British checkpoint, and fighting for Basra was still going on. Didn't have my graphic map. And at this point, Salem's troops had set fire to the oil pits. It wasn't actually oil wells, unlike the 91 conflict. They'd literally leaked out oil and filled up pits, which in hindsight is really clever. To all the media, where any film footage of Basra, it always looked like the city was being destroyed and on fire. In which case, this is probably quite a unique war. There's very little bomb damage, and you know, it really was precision munitions that would just take down one tower block. But to anyone looking at it on the news, it looked like hell, and it looks like there's coalition forces have trashed the place. There must be so many civilians dead. So very clever, and it stopped all the aerial surveillance. so they couldn't tell what effect the artillery and the bombing was having on it. So